Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Welcome to Most Notorious. I'm Eric Rivenis. Happy Chinese New Year to all of you. And to help mark the holiday, we're crossing the ocean to old China, just prior to the Japanese occupation, to investigate the murder of a young English woman in 1937. This is our first foray outside of the American borders, and a doozy of a story to boot. I'm so pleased to welcome as my guest Paul French, the author of the best-selling book Midnight in Peking, which also won an Edgar Award in 2013. I appreciate your time today, sir.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
There's so many compelling characters in the story you present, but none more so than the city itself, Peking, now known, of course, as Beijing. Before we get into the details of the murder, tell us about Peking, China in 1937, specifically the Legation Quarter and the Badlands, which play such prominent roles in this book.
Yes, well, Peking was not the capital of China in 1937. Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of Nationalist China, had moved the capital to Nanjing, down south. And so because Peking was quite close to Manchuria that the Japanese had already occupied in the early 1930s, it had actually become somewhat of a frontier town. It was sort of the last stop before you got to Japanese-occupied China. And in 1937, it wasn't so much a case of if Japan would invade China. It was a case of when. So the city was an extremely nervous place. It was not the capital of China. It was not the financial center or business center of China. That was down south as well, in Shanghai. But it was still a Chinese city, and a very ancient Chinese city. There were about 3 million people living there, which made it a fairly big city at the time. Shanghai was a little bit bigger, but that was still a large city, even by world standards. And there were about 3,000 foreigners, non-Chinese, living in the city and calling it home. Now, even though the government had moved to Nanjing, many of the embassies, which were now technically consulates, stayed in Beijing. And of course, they had always been in that city, and they had clustered together in an area just to the east of what is now Tiananmen Square, in an area called the Legation Quarter. A legation is just another word for an embassy or a consulate. And all of the foreign legations, the British, the Russians, the Germans, the Americans, and the Japanese were all there in European-style buildings that they had built themselves after the Boxer Uprising of 1900 destroyed the area. If you've seen Charlton Heston in 55 Days in Peking, you'll know that story. And they rebuilt in a European style. And most of it is still there today, an odd sort of area of European architecture right in the center of modern-day Beijing.
So your book starts with the discovery of a young murdered woman. Can you talk about the details regarding the discovery of her body?
Yes, she was a young girl. They thought 19 years of age. She was a white girl, blonde hair, gray eyes. And she was found just outside the city walls at a place called the Fox Tower. Now, the Fox Tower was an area that for many Chinese at the time was associated with ghosts, was considered quite a desolate area. It was near many of the cemeteries of old Peking. And her body was discovered there early one morning, on January the 8th, which is technically the Russian Christmas. There were many Russians living in China at that time, what we call white Russians, those that had fled the Soviet Union and were living outside of their country, a lot of them in Peking, a lot in Shanghai and elsewhere in China. And so that was a much celebrated event in a big night out in Beijing. And her body was found there early in the morning. It was quite clear that, number one, sadly, the body had been mutilated to some extent. And number two, it was not a robbery. For instance, a platinum watch that she was wearing — platinum watches were very expensive at the time — was still on her wrist, and in fact had stopped at just about midnight, hence the title of the book. And that had not been taken, which immediately led the police to not see this as a robbery, a crime of opportunity, but to see this as a murder, and a particularly savage and brutal murder.
So the investigation into her murder is jointly conducted by both British and Chinese authorities, which, as you point out in your book, was a pretty unique arrangement for the time. Can you tell us about this odd cooperation?
Yeah, well, that obviously interested me very much as someone who is a historian of China and writes about China, particularly foreigners in China in the first half of the 20th century. This bit intrigued me because, for instance, obviously, if you look at China, Shanghai and Tianjin, these cities were what we call treaty ports. They were places where foreigners had certain rights, the most important rights being that they could have their own police force and their own justice system. But Peking wasn't like that. Peking was an entirely Chinese city with a Chinese police force and detective division. However, because of the number of foreigners there and the importance of those foreigners, it being the legation quarter, ambassadors and so on, it had always been the tradition that if a foreigner was murdered, the Chinese police would investigate, but they would invite someone from that person's legation, from that person's embassy, to be involved. Now, normally the murders were fairly obvious. They were a couple of American Marines getting drunk and stabbing each other, or a couple of British soldiers getting in a fight and killing a rickshaw puller or something. These cases were cleaned up very quickly. Someone from the embassy could come along and help translate and see that justice was done. However, in this case, a number of things were different. Number one, they had no suspect in the murder. And number two, the girl that was murdered turned out to be the daughter of a former British diplomat in China, a very well-respected and long-serving diplomat in China who had retired and become a China scholar, and was very well respected by the Chinese government and other China scholars around the world. The family was also quite wealthy, and this made it quite tricky. It was also the case that in Tianjin, where there were foreign concessions, a British concession, French concession, Italian concession, and so on, the British maintained their own police force, and running that police force was a former Scotland Yard detective who had taken a job working for the British government in Tianjin and had experiences of murder investigations in London. And so he was sent to Peking to work with the head of the Peking Detective Division. So I think that this level of cooperation, this level of collaboration between a senior Chinese detective and a senior British policeman and trained detective working in China at the time was really unprecedented. It never happened before, and it never happened again.
So immediately, suspicions turned to ETC Werner, the girl's father, simply because, as most of us who follow true crime already know, family members are often involved in murders. And her father was an odd man with a rather dodgy past.
Yeah, I mean, he dodgy's a rather contemporary word, but he kind of he was a strange man in many ways. Edward Theodore Chalmers Werner was his full name. His father was actually German, or actually probably a citizen of the Austro, as was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who had married an English woman and after traveling around the world a little bit with his family, had settled in England. So Werner himself probably would have been Werner, but it was anglicized to Werner before the First World War. Went to a rather good English public school and then trained for the Foreign Service and specialized in Chinese, and so went to China. He'd been out in China since the 1890s and had got himself something of a reputation as a rather individual, rather a character, absolutely brilliant linguist, probably spoke 7 Chinese dialects as well as German, English, Portuguese. He had spent some time in the Portuguese colony of Macau and learned Portuguese. So extremely good linguist, quite amazing. Very good scholar as well. When he wasn't being a diplomat, he was a scholar. He had married late in life to a woman who was, we would say in England, was of blue blood. She was from a sort of well-connected family that had made its money originally in India with the East India Company. And he had married her and moved back to China. But he had been back in England for a short period to find a wife, basically, as they did. And when they got back to China, they adopted a young girl. And this was the young girl, Pamela Werner, who was murdered in 1937. So she was the adopted daughter. His wife had died in the 1920s. And there had been rumors at the time that I think when you dive into it, although some people thought he might have murdered her, and he staunchly said that she was just sick and died, and she certainly had been unwell. I think from what I can tell of everything that was recorded at the British Embassy by the doctors there and everything, it was what we might now call an assisted suicide. But of course, an assisted suicide in the 1920s was as illegal and controversial then as it is now. But rumors swirled around the man, and he didn't care. He didn't really care for other people's company. He preferred his scholarly texts and his academic work. And of course, you know, he was a man who described himself as not being one of the herd. And so although he was admired in many ways, he was somewhat considered an outsider within what was a very tight-knit European community. You know, there weren't that many foreigners in China. Europeans and Americans tended to stick together. The British, of course, were a very clannish bunch and stuck together even more. And so when someone really wasn't part of the sort of club, Somerset Maugham type clubman environment, they did tended to be talked about and gossiped about a little bit.
But he definitely had some interesting moments in his past, according to your book. I mean, at one point he uses a horsewhip to flog a group of monks at a temple. And in another episode, he's presiding over the trial of an Englishman accused of killing a Chinese man and assists in the cover-up of the murder.
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly an Englishman of his generation. He was always considered a friend of China and considered friendly to the Chinese. However, there was an incident where he went into the temples. See, all of these can always be seen in two ways, though. There was an incident where he had gone into a temple where there were some Buddhist monks begging. Now, Buddhist monks begging sounds like a very charitable and nice endeavor, but often, as you could still see if you went to Thailand, Buddhist monks can sometimes be rather extortionist in their demands and often come from strange backgrounds. So the fact that one of them was pestering the person that he was with and he took a horsewhip to them, not good, but we don't quite know the circumstances. Certainly when he was in the very small treaty port, trading treaty port of Kukyang, which is in inland China, he was involved in as a judge. A consul there was a judge as well. And he had actually a legal background. He had spent some time training at the Middle Temple in London as part of his consular training. So he did know the law. And there does appear to a bit. Now, to say it was a cover-up, yes, that definitely is possible that he did cover up the murder or the killing by an Englishman struck a Chinese with his stick and the Chinese died. I don't think we could say that he had the intention to kill him. So it's a killing rather than a murder, I guess, but or manslaughter rather than homicide. But that it does appear that it wasn't. He definitely did side on the side of British justice. He was a man of empire. He was a man of the imperial world in that sense. He was a man who took offense very easily. There were several instances where he thought that men were spying on his wife, sort of peeping toms were spying on his wife or maybe making inappropriate suggestions, and he got into disagreements and fights there. He was a man who had some adventures as well. He went several times into Mongolia looking for the tomb of Genghis Khan, which of course has still never been found, and went into inland China many times. Later on, after his wife died, he often went and left his daughter at boarding school, which some people, I think more in a contemporary sense rather than at the time, felt that that was a rather cold thing to do. I know when I've been on book tours in America and you talk about children being sent to boarding school while parents go off on explorations or to work and so on, people always think of that as being very cold and so on. However, it was and is for many of us the way things are done. So you know, we have to sort of try and look at him through the eyes of a man of his generation and class rather than the contemporary sort of notions of parenting and life.
So back to the investigation. The police obviously feel some pressure to get this solved. This is a woman of fine upbringing. There's a lot of worry in the white community over her murder, and all sorts of rumors abound. But the police have a suspect pretty quickly. He's a Canadian named Pinfold. Can you talk about his arrest and interrogation?
Yes, well, there was a lot of pressure on the investigation from the start. I have to say, from the British government in China at the time, which was, look, you know, we have a problem here, chaps, which is that we can't look weak in front of the Chinese, particularly with the Japanese about to invade China. This is all going to get very messy for us and our business and imperial interests. So best that you find a Chinese, find one quickly and hang them and let's move on from this. Now, it was to the credit of both policemen that they refused to do that and continued to investigate it. But they realized very quickly that this was most unlikely to have been a crime committed quite by chance by a sort of mad Chinese, which was sort of the thinking of many in the British government at the time. And they realized that the crime had come probably from events within the foreign community in China, which was really a goldfish bowl. Everybody knew everybody. So this was quite alarming on many levels and was very much looked like it was going to become a washing of dirty laundry for the foreign community in China. However, there was one section of the foreign community in China that spent a lot of time in an area of Peking, which has been very little researched and talked about, called the Badlands, which was really bars, brothels, opium dens, and so on. Not for the Chinese. They had their own Badlands, of course, in other parts of the city. But this was really for the foreign soldiers that were stationed in town and any ne'er-do-wells passing through the city and anyone with inclinations that way living in Peking at the time. And they found connections there with many people that were really quite indigent, quite hard to pin down. It was quite possible to move around China without a passport. It was quite possible to pass yourself off as another person or completely hide and obscure your origins and what you were doing there. Peking was in many ways the edge of the world at this point if you wanted to get away from Europe or North America or somewhere. And they did find one man, a man called Pinfold, although to this day, and since I did the book, I've done a lot, tried to do a lot more research on him and not really got anywhere, who, as far as we know, was called something like Pinfold or Penfold, may well have been in the Canadian Army around the time of the First World War, may well have deserted from the Canadian Army and gone to America, appears to have been involved in various criminal activities just after the First World War in Chicago, where he was wanted by the police, may have served some prison time in the United States, managed to get on a ship, came to China as a former soldier, sold his services to a warlord at that time, one of these warlords that controlled parts of rather ungovernable China in the 1920s, as a bodyguard, and had found his way into Peking that way. Had then, of course, fallen on slightly hard times, didn't have much money, maybe had a drug problem, like the opium pipe a little bit too much, and spent a lot of time in the Badlands, and his name came up in the investigation. And when they got to his lodgings, a very down at heel flop house in the city, some blood and a knife were found there. And so they certainly thought that they had their man, and they'd also realized that the investigation was going to take them into this underworld, this netherworld of the badlands of Peking, the most undesirable foreigners in China, really.
And then suddenly, Dennis, the British detective, is called to a city called Tientsin, where he's briefed, and he's pretty shocked in this briefing about a scandal involving Pamela Werner at her school. Can you explain what happened with Pamela in Tientsin?
Yes, well, what was very interesting was that when they originally came across the case, Pamela was always presented in the newspapers at the time and in most people's memories as being a nice English girl, quite pretty, not perhaps the most beautiful girl, but certainly doing quite well. Not the star student, but doing quite well in her exams and so on. When we started to investigate a little bit, what we found was that Pamela was like many girls in their late teens, really on the cusp of womanhood, and was starting to date and not always date the right people, and was starting to be attractive to older men, and was starting to want to go out at night to sample the delights of restaurants and hotels and bars and parties and so on. And there was also some gossip about her at her school. Her school was away in the British concession in Tianjin, which is only about 70 miles from Peking. There was a train. It was a very good school. It was run on sort of British public school lines. It was the Tientsin Grammar School. And she was there. But halfway through the investigation, when people were starting to speculate about who may have done this, rumors that had been really hidden by the school before came out, that perhaps the headmaster of the school had been overly friendly with Pamela and had made improper advances towards her. So the rumor immediately circulated that he had made improper advances to her. She had rebuffed those advances, and he had murdered her. It also turned out that she had a boyfriend in Tianjin. He was ruled out quite quickly, that he had an alibi for the evening. He wasn't in the city of Peking. But the school had certainly panicked, and the headmaster had been unceremoniously removed from his post, and literally within a matter of days, bundled onto a train and sent back to England. Sent back to England so hurriedly, in fact, that they didn't even wait for a boat to England to arrive in China. They put him on the next boat which came, which was a boat to Japan. And in Japan, they put him on a boat to California. And in California, they put him on a train to New York. And in New York, they put him on a boat to England. And in England, they put him on a train to Oxford, where he disappears and becomes a school secretary for the rest of his life. Now, it seems unlikely, although to this day, there certainly are people who are in their late 90s now, who were at the school at the time, who have all sorts of opinions about that headmaster and what he may or may not have done. But in terms of where he was that evening, it appears that he could not have done it. But this was certainly a side investigation and a distraction for DCI Dennis, the British detective involved in the case, who had to go back to Tianjin to sort out this mess back there, find out that in terms of the actual murder itself, it didn't lead very far before he could come back to Beijing and continue to follow the trail, which was, of course, cooling the whole time he was away.
Yeah, and he got out of there really quickly. And that's one of the really interesting threads in your book, this idea of people disappearing. A lot of the suspects and possible witnesses kind of came and went, and it was hard to track their movements in this shadowy Chinese underworld. And it turns out to be really frustrating for the investigation.
Yeah, yes. People moved around China all the time, and they were able to do that. If you landed on a boat in Shanghai, for instance, any time in the 1930s, you weren't asked for any documentation when you came ashore. It's one of the reasons why so many Jewish refugees went there in the late 1930s, and why so many Russian refugees who were stateless citizens had gone there after 1917 and the Bolshevik Revolution, because you did not need paperwork to move around. So if you turned up and declared your name to be Paul French and said you were born in London, and was a former soldier, you might well find yourself with work. No one could really check anything. I mean, the technology wasn't there to really look into people's backgrounds, and the systems weren't there either. So people drop in and drop out. And of course, a lot of these people are involved in narcotics, they're involved in robbery, they're involved in obviously murder, but they're also involved in prostitution and things like this. And they're not the sort of people who really use their real names or give their real ages or talk about their past. And of course, they're not like diplomats and businessmen and people like that, the sort that write their memoirs and leave them for us to read later and put two and two together. These are people who have gone to China to be off the map. They've gone to escape something, and they don't have any interest in advertising their presence. And so that makes them, for a researcher, as well as for a researcher now, as well as for a policeman in 1937, makes them incredibly elusive and very difficult to track down.
We will be back after a brief break.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906, when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
And we have returned. So Detective Dennis, in his investigation, grows suspicious of an American dentist named Wentworth Prentice, who has his own pretty questionable past. What was Prentice's background, and how did Dennis get turned on to his possible involvement?
Well, Dennis started to discover that and Inspector Chen as well, who was working with him, started to discover there were a group of men and a couple of women, actually, who were very involved in the Badlands in terms of hosting parties and gathering together. They went hunting together outside the city. They went up to old temples where they arranged what was then at the time referred to as a nudist resort. You can speculate on what that might have been. And they were known to be in and out of the bars and the brothels of that area, that drugs were involved and so on. Prentice was a dentist from the East Coast of America. He had gone to China very early and built himself up a business as a dentist to foreigners in Peking, and a well-respected dentist in many ways, and was married with several children. But the Prentice that many people seem to have known in Peking at that time and the real man seemed to be two very different things as far as one can tell. The records of the American legation, the American consulate in Peking, mention him numerous times, and those records are now in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Anyone can go and see them. And they raise a slight awareness in very delicate language of the 1930s about the welfare of Prentice's children. There seems to be some accusation that the children may be at risk, to use modern language, that the children may be at risk from some sort of abuse. There's no indication as to whether this is verbal, physical, sexual, or whatever, but that the children are at some abuse. Anyway, whatever happens, although Prentice passes himself off as a happily married man to most of his customers, his wife has taken the children gotten on a boat several years before, gone to Los Angeles, and never returns to China. None of the children ever return to China. He never returns to the United States and stays there, remains as a dentist, but also becomes quite notorious for being out and about in the badlands of Peking at night. So the police are naturally very interested in him, but it seems bizarre that a dentist could be involved in all of these things. And I think what that reveals is just the overlap within this area of the badlands of Peking between, if you like, the polite society of Peking, the people that are there attending embassy receptions and very lovely parties and having tiffin at the grand hotels and so on, and this kind of underclass and underbelly group. There was an overlap between the two, and it is in that overlap that the answer to the murder of Pamela Werner and the reasons for that murder lie.
So Detective Dennis and Captain Han are trying to put these pieces together, and they're generally on the right trail, but aren't really gaining any traction. And then their investigation comes to an abrupt stop when the Japanese advance into the city. Can you talk about how the Japanese occupation affects the investigation?
Yeah, well, the murder happens in January. The investigation goes on. It's taking a long time. Nobody's talking, but they are starting to get closer and closer to the truth. They're starting to pry it open. But in July 1937, the inevitable, which I think most of the city had been worried about, happens. And the Japanese invade, capture, and occupy Peking and Tianjin as well, and then start their move south. So that's July 1937. By August 1937, the Japanese are bombing Shanghai. A month later is the horrific so-called rape of Nanjing. And really, full-scale war between China and Japan. Now, I would argue that if you look at the Japanese invasion of China, which is largely successful, and then, of course, the Japanese continue to move across Asia. So, you know, within a couple of years, we are in a situation where there is no one in control in the Pacific except the British Empire. But, of course, after Pearl Harbor, we lose Hong Kong and Singapore, and that's the British Empire finished there. And there's nothing left but America and Japan facing each other. So I think if you track back, you can almost see that the invasion of Peking in July 1937 is really the start of the Second World War in the Pacific. And that's very important, I think, to understand that once Japan invades Peking, everything changes. For a start, everything changes because Inspector Han has to go on other duties and has to get out of the city because he is also an officer of the Chinese government, so the Japanese will be after him. Inspector Dennis has to get back to Tianjin because that is his primary job, is to defend now literally and militarily Tianjin from the Japanese. And of course, once the Japanese invade, he can't get out of Tianjin. So the whole investigation and everything to do with it, the reporting on it, everything just comes to a massive grinding halt with the world events just overtake the investigation completely. And the two policemen are both have to get out of the city and are unable to pursue the investigation. The Japanese occupying army, of course, has no interest in Pamela Werner, who murdered her. And the whole thing just comes to a halt.
So Werner is left on his own and decides to act himself, basically out of desperation. And he begins to fund his own investigation into his daughter's death. Tell us about some of his interviews and how he's able to piece together a clearer version of what really happened.
But this is really the amazing part of the book for me, Eric, because, you know, I thought that I wanted to write a book about foreigners in China that might reach a wider audience and raise some of these issues and you know, recall this incredible time and place. And I thought, well, you know, you have a murder, you have this unique experience of a Chinese and a European detective working together. You have the sophisticated world of the legation quarter and the embassies. And on the other hand, you have these badlands and foreigners involved in prostitution and drug dealing and things like this. And I thought all of that is just an incredible world, and it's a great investigation to follow. And at the end of it, the case is never solved, not because of police incompetence, but because of or the fact that these guys can't cooperate, but because World War II comes to China and priorities change. And I thought, well, that's the end of the book, you know. I mean, China changes then. We never go back to the old China. It's 7-8 years of war, then it's 4 years of civil war, then it's communist revolution. I mean, that old China of January 1937 just never comes back. These are really the last days of that old China. And I thought that might be enough for a book. And I thought, well, what can you do? You don't always solve crimes. This is just part of our world that we live in. Murder isn't always solved. It's not like watching CSI wherever on television and the whole thing gets wrapped up 5 minutes before the news and killer goes to jail. It doesn't work like that in real life sometimes, right, particularly right. Not in places where society and things are so unfair as they were in China in 1937 and war intervenes. And I was digging around trying to see if I could just find anything else about some of these people, because they were hard to find, in the UK's National Archives here in London. And a lot has been digitized and a lot has been indexed and catalogued. But United Kingdom, obviously, given the amount of countries we've had involvement in over the years and the long history of the country, there's just boxes and boxes and boxes of paperwork over at Kew. It goes like 7 stories underground. I mean, some boxes have never been opened. Who knows what's there? And they start to catalogue it, but it's taking forever. And I was searching around different boxes, and I saw on the internet, you know, on the records there on the internet, that there was a box of paperwork from the British Embassy in Beijing from 1943. And I thought, well, what's in a box of stuff from the British Embassy in Beijing in 1943? There was no British Embassy in 1943. Of course, the British had to leave when the Japanese invaded. Well, we left shortly afterwards. Of course, in 1941, after Pearl Harbor with America, we go to war with Japan. So we're unable to stay there. Who was in the British Embassy to be sending anything back? So I called this box up and I opened it, and it's literally a dusty box. And inside I realized that it's nothing. It's old paperwork from Beijing that was sent back just before Pearl Harbor, when the British finally had to leave. And they sent back as much paperwork as they could on ships to get it out so that the Japanese couldn't read it. And because of the war and the disruption to shipping, it took until 1943 for all these boxes to finally get to London. When they got to London in 1943, nobody bothered to open them because, well, London in 1943 had bigger things to worry about than what was going on in Beijing several years earlier. And so they were just shelved away and recorded as Beijing Embassy 1943. But when I went through it, I found that there was about a 150-page document in there, typed up with lots of handwritten notes and annotations, which was from ETC Werner, Pamela's father, and it was the record of this investigation he had conducted himself after July 1937, when he was still able to move around the city, but it was becoming increasingly lawless. It was controlled by the Japanese. The Chinese police were no longer operating. And he conducted his own investigation to try and find out who had murdered his daughter and what had happened that night. And he used pretty much all of his own money. I mean, a lot of this, of course, would be problematic in court because he paid people to tell him things. People who would not talk to the police, he paid them money. People were really desperate at that time, so they would have said anything for money. And therein, of course, lies one of the problems with paying people to tell you things. But he managed to do that. Other people were helpful to him because he was not a policeman. Other people felt that now that the British government was effectively kicked out of China and there was no policing, that by saying what they knew and what had happened, it wouldn't make any difference anyway, now that the Japanese are in control. So he went through all of his money trying to do this. He damaged his health severely. He was not a young man at the time. He was 70 because he had adopted Pamela. He was older. He was 70 at the time of her murder. He had several heart attacks while he was investigating this. And ultimately, staying here to do this, it meant that he stayed in China too long. And so after 1941, when the Japanese finally rounded up all the British, American, and other allied nationals in China and sent them into internment camps, which are really prison camps, for the duration of the war. He went into a prison camp. Again, horrific conditions for a man of that age, though he did survive and come out. He managed to get all of these notes together, all of these testimonies together, all of this evidence together, put it down and send it back to London. But the problem, as I've said, was in 1943, when bombs were falling on London and Hitler and Tojo still had to be defeated, you know, no one had time to deal with this stuff. And so it just went into the files and got forgotten.
So he talks to lots and lots of people, as you mentioned, spends a ton of cash and digs up some really unsavory suspects. And even more interesting, starts linking them together as friends and potential accomplices. We just don't have time, of course, to go through all the twists and turns of the story, all of the characters involved. But I do want to mention one witness that he finds, and it's honestly a really devastating moment in the book for me. It's when Werner questions the rickshaw driver, who says that he took what appeared to be a lifeless Pamela Werner, along with a couple of shadowy characters, from a brothel in the Badland to the Fox Tower, where you submit that they plan to dispose of the body. And there was blood on the seat as well. And the rickshaw driver told Werner that he'd already given this information to Captain Han early in the investigation, but Han had kept the information to himself.
There were several problems with the rickshaw driver at the time. One was that there had been an American Marine in town who had been stabbed, and it was thought that maybe it was his blood. The rickshaw puller was thought to be unreliable. It was slightly problematic at the time, and Han ruled it as unimportant.
I guess what I took from how you worded it in the book was that Han might have had something to do with a cover-up.
Yeah, well, one of the elements of it is not necessarily that Han was involved in a cover-up of the murder. I mean, I do believe that he wanted to solve the murder. The problem was that the bars and the brothels of and the businesses of the Badlands, including the rickshaw pullers and the companies that they worked for, were all paying off the police. In a sense, Han had an interest in diverting the investigation away from the Badlands. Now, I think that he did not think that he was ultimately perverting the course of justice, although I think in the end he probably did. But it shows you the problem with corruption. Because he was taking a bit of money from each of these bars, and as I say, the rickshaw pullers as well were being, if you like, taxed by the police, it meant that, of course, he tended to look in one direction rather than another, because he had compromised himself over a long period of time. And that was another problem to the investigation, and one Dennis could not have known about, because he wouldn't have known the internal workings of the Beijing police to that level.
And part of what Han was doing was diverting interest from this bar/brothel that the rickshaw driver had claimed he'd been at when he picked up Pamela's murderers and her body, basically. And this bar was owned by a half-Korean woman, a madam, who, interestingly, packs up and hightails it out of Peking the day that Pamela's body is discovered.
It was a real melting pot in that area. She was a half Korean, part Russian. She was living at various times with a former American GI of ancestry of Italian extraction originally, who had been stationed at the Legation Guard with the 4th Marines and had then left and stayed in China. There's a whole group of those guys with various backgrounds. And these were bars that were paying off the police, as bars do in Beijing today and in many cities around the world. And so when something happens, the police tend to have to, obviously they've taken the money, so they have to misdirect the investigation. And again, I think what Werner found was that this had not been helpful. And I think it's questionable as to whether or not the murder would have been solved if they'd have gone that way. But, you know, people weren't talking. And I think as long as the police were involved, none of these people would have talked. After the Japanese invaded, everybody needed to get some money. Everybody was willing to talk for money. And that, of course, is problematic. But I think if you take what the police were able to find in their investigation, before the Japanese occupation than what Werner was able to get, even though there are problems with the police testimony because of misdirection, and there are problems with Werner's testimony because he paid for it. If you match the things up, I think you can come at least as close as is possible to the truth.
So you wrap up your book with a pretty convincing theory about the last few hours of Pamela's life. And without getting into too many details, can you give us some hints as to how her last evening unfolded?
I think that the way to understand it is that there was this world, this underbelly of Peking society called the Badland. And within that were all sorts of people, desperate white Russians who had no skills except to be involved in crime or prostitution or drug dealing. There were men of various different backgrounds who had been with the Marines, the American Marines in China, and afterwards had stayed on in China either because they married local women or they became involved in various things. And these also became quite desperate men. And there were also men among them who had what would be the word, exotic tastes in terms of drugs and sex and things like that. And I think that Pamela, through perhaps no fault of her own, except just being a curious girl, becoming a woman, became involved with this group of people and didn't realize who she was becoming involved with until it was too late. And I think that's about as much as I can say without sort of doing the spoilers that get you shot by your publisher. I think it's that incredible world that she was not part of, that she accidentally stepped into seeking adventure and found herself, if you like, on the wrong side of the tracks, and then, you know, was never able to get justice or have her murderers brought to justice because World War, you know, the most calamitous event of the 20th century, occurred, and she was just one person, and, you know, within months of her murder, millions of people were dying across China. And within a couple of years of that, you know, millions of people across the whole of the Pacific and of course, back in Europe.
I don't think it's too much to say, though, that this American dentist, Wentworth Prentice, is the primary focus of E.T.C. Werner in his personal investigation, and one of the people you propose killed her.
All of these characters are involved in their own ways. This is not one of those things where one person walks up to another, murders them, and walks away again. It is a conspiracy involving a large number of people who are trying to cover up much wider things that they're involved in, and happen to exist in a place and at a time where I think I used the phrase in the book, and people caught onto it a little bit when the book came out, which is, you know, they're in a place and a time where they've lost their moral compass, and they have ceased to act in a rational, law-abiding way. And I think that is something that happened at that time because it was a time of anarchy and chaos thanks to the Japanese invasion of the country.
So finally, the Japanese start to get aggressive and begin interning the Westerners in Peking, as you mentioned. And Werner finds himself in prison with none other than Wentworth Prentice, the American dentist, who his evidence points to as being involved in his daughter's death.
Well, he was in prison with any number of people, actually, that he believed may have been involved or have known things connected to his daughter's murder. One of the things that I didn't realize when I was researching the book, and I knew quite a lot about internment, and I think if people have seen the film Empire of the Sun, the story of J.G. Ballard's internment in Shanghai and other films or read memoirs, we think of them as being, you know, the businessmen's families and the diplomats' families, but all of the ne'er-do-wells, all of the prostitutes, all of the drug addicts. I mean, when you dive into it and you talk to people, they remember wafer-thin, yellow-skinned, I mean, yellow-skinned because of the opium addiction, brought into the camps. People that the foreign community hadn't known anything about for years, people who had been prisoners, and they were suddenly in these internment camps with men who had been policemen, with men who had been in the diplomatic service and so on. So the prison camps really replicated that overlap between the legation quarter life and the Badlands life. And yes, Werner was in the camp with people that he believed were responsible for his daughter's death. But by that time, he was often considered by many people to be a slightly eccentric old man. He pointed out several people and said, I know you were involved. And when he pointed to the first person, people thought maybe that was who he thought did it. Then when he pointed to another person and another person, people just thought maybe he was mad, maybe, you know, some form of dementia had set in. But it may indeed, of course, have been that he knew far more than anyone else in the camp could have realized. And of course, what they didn't know, but we do know, because I uncovered the documents, is that, you know, he had put together, I believe, a very convincing case for who were the people involved in the conspiracy that ended in the murder of Pamela Werner.
There must have been some great satisfaction in pulling this murder out of obscurity and getting some vindication for ETC Werner, and in a sense, some justice for Pamela Werner. Not the perfect kind of justice where her murderers are punished for their crimes, but at least you've exposed them for history's sake.
Well, I think so. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, there isn't going to be any trials. There isn't going to be any retroactive stuff. And of course, the China that the murder occurred in is nothing really in relation to the China of today. This is before the Communist Revolution. It's a long time before. Most of the people involved are now dead. They've been dead for a long time. Although I did find some people that were still alive and remembered Pamela and remembered the case. But I think that for all of us, really, this is true as well, because, you know, there's a Chinese translation of the book, and I spent a lot of time talking to Chinese audiences about the book as well. But both in Western and Eastern culture, there's something that is very unsettling to us about unsolved murders. You know, the idea that that people can commit murder and get away with it, that murderers walk among us completely free. Cases get forgotten, cases get lost, there isn't always justice, is a very unsettling one to us. Whatever our religious or ideological or ethical beliefs, it's extremely unsettling that murder will not always be avenged. And I think that's what a lot of people have caught onto with the book.
I know that you've been very busy with the screen adaptation of your book. How are things going with that?
Well, you know, television moves very, very slowly, but we are getting places slowly. We are hopefully moving forward. Certainly, the money's there, and a script is almost there, and we have executive producers and everything, and we are moving towards making the book as an 8-part series for British TV with some involvement. With some American money and some involvement from a, I can't say the name, I'm afraid, but if I said it, you would absolutely know the major cable network that I'm talking about.
Do you have a dream actor that you'd like to see as a lead for Werner or for Pamela?
Well, yeah, of course, you know, everyone thinks about it, and there's any number of actors in the mix. I mean, Pamela is young, so it's a chance for a young actress there, perhaps someone we don't know as yet. But certainly Werner is an older man, a man of some gravitas. And so I think one naturally thinks of British actors like Michael Gambon, for instance, and people of that age and ilk who have that kind of screen intensity that would hopefully carry through the role of this man who in many ways is seen as when you first meet him in the book, he's seen as quite a cold, perhaps slightly unloving father who doesn't perhaps pay enough attention to his daughter, but in the end you know, is absolutely relentless and sacrifices, you know, his pension and his health and his freedom in order to try and track down the people that killed his daughter. And I think that when people read the book, the feedback I get from book groups and things is, you know, people are very unsure of the father at first. He seems very cold, very distant. And yet by the end of the book, people are really rooting for him and feeling very sorry for how things turned out for him. And I think, you know, that requires an actor of some intensity.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's been great talking about it.
Midnight in Peking by Paul French is available through online retailers like Amazon and brick-and-mortar bookstores everywhere. This has been the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and I hope you have a great Chinese New Year.